Well, good evening. So tonight we are taking a little bit of a hiatus from our journey through some of the Old Testament books. However, we're still going to give attention to the Old Testament tonight. I love the Old Testament. I think the Old Testament is outstanding. I don't know what that was for. What a surprise! I think it's great. But this is an attempt to kind of bridge a gap, if there is one, between what we talked about this past Sunday and what we'll continue talking about this coming Sunday in those threads of resurrection hope in the Old Testament. So we are this Sunday celebrating Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, as some of us may call it. Did you know, by the way, that there is more than one Easter Sunday in the world? Some of you probably know, like, this is not news to all of you, I'm sure. I was on the phone yesterday. I had a video call with one of our guys, good friends over in Moldova. And so the Orthodox calendar has Easter usually a week off from us. So I asked him, I was like, oh, your Easter is probably a week from Sunday. He said, no, our Easter this year is May the 5th. So they've got, you know, they've got it coming still a ways off. But then he said, and I agree with him, he said, but you know, every Sunday is Resurrection Sunday. That's why we meet every Sunday, because he is risen. And I agree with that. So here we are meeting on a Wednesday. So I guess this is Resurrection Wednesday. I don't have a PowerPoint tonight. I don't even have a handout for you tonight. I hope you have a Bible, because what I want to do is to have you looking at that for the most part. And we're going to do a fair amount of moving through this. Some of you will still want to take notes just because that's what you like to do. I know those types because I can tend to be one. So if you were to take notes, the way I have this numbered is I've got about 10 different examples I want to give. So it's not imperative that you get 10, but I wrote them down in that and numbered them that way. So keeping in mind what we examined at the beginning of Sunday morning from 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul says that I delivered to you that which is of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried and he was raised again on the third day according to the Scriptures. And we mentioned how that phrase, according to the Scriptures, it seems to indicate that there are indications in the Old Testament, in the Scriptures, that's what Paul probably would have had in mind, in those Scriptures, that these, that this death and third day resurrection is embedded in those Old Testament Scriptures. And yet there's not one place where you could point to and say, okay, that's what Paul has in mind. There seem to be a number of these kinds of patterns instead that would lead the New Testament readers and those who would have learned from Jesus and the apostles to then understand, oh, that's what you're referring back to, or that's the fulfillment of these patterns. And we tried to show on Sunday that Jonah was one of those. But there are others that probably could be sermons on their own, but instead of trying to preach a sermon on all of these, we'll kind of fly through, as I said, about 10 or so today. And then this coming Sunday, we'll spend more extended amount of time on one more, again, just because it seems to be more explicit, I guess, or more worth such attention, in my opinion. So we will start in Genesis. Most of these are going to go chronologically through your Bibles, but there might be some jumping around just because there is a certain order I want to attempt to trace these in. And some of these we'll give more attention to than others, but we will start in Genesis. So I would ask, first of all, that you go to Genesis 40, Genesis chapter 40. So the loose time frame on this is from for tonight at least, is from Jacob to Daniel. That's kind of the parameters I have in mind, but we'll hit several along the way. So Jacob, of course, being one of the earliest patriarchs in Genesis, Daniel being one of the last prophets in the timeline of the Old Testament. So now, I also would add that I'm not saying that these are all of the examples. There probably are more that I either haven't noticed, haven't thought about, you know, didn't come to mind as I traced this through. So there might be more. It also might be that, you know, as I read some of these, you might say, that's not as clear to me. So it could be. I hope I'm not reading into these too much. But again, what I'm trying to show you more than, you know, proving any particular point, really the point that I would want to prove is just that there are patterns. You know, not that each one is equally important or obvious, but just that there are patterns. Does that make sense? Now, as I've said before, this kind of setting being a little more informal, a little more give and take, I welcome your feedback, welcome your questions, comments along the way. So don't shy away from that. You know, throw your hand in the air or shout at me, whatever needs to be done, okay? Anything before we jump in? Okay, here we go. Number one, it occurs in the life, actually, of one of Jacob's sons, Joseph, but we'll look at it first just because it kind of comes first in the text. So in Genesis 40, the context here is that Joseph has not only been sold by his brothers to be a slave in Egypt, he has actually, at this point, been put in prison in Egypt because of the accusation of Potiphar's wife that he had attempted to attack her, which of course was false, but he was imprisoned nonetheless. And while he was in prison, there were two other prisoners there. There was a baker, one who had been a baker for the Pharaoh, and then there was one who had been a butler for the Pharaoh. Both of those men had dreams and were troubled by those dreams, thinking that they meant something. They tell the dreams to Joseph. Joseph is then able to give an interpretation for those dreams and then to tell them what the outcome would be for them. And of course, for one, it was very good news. For the other one, it was very bad news. So look at verse 16. I'll kind of pick it up there. 40:16. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation for the butler was favorable, and if you look on, let me back up. Sorry, just a little bit further, just because there's previous references there. So, verse 12. Joseph said to the cupbearer, to the butler, this is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. You shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me. And you know, he says that way I can be brought out of this prison because I was put here unjustly. So then verse 16, the baker saw that interpretation was favorable. So he said to Joseph, I also had a dream that there were 3 cake baskets on my head. The uppermost basket, there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating out of it of the basket on my head. Verse 18, and Joseph answered and said, this is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you. Verse 20, on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the cupbearer to his position and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hands, but he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. So, again, without reading into the details, anything that the author would not want us to see there, you see some interesting things there. You see a man being hanged on a tree. You see another who has life given to him instead of the death of being hanged on a tree, and that life is given to him on which day? On the third day. Okay? So, you know, what does that tell us? What does that, you know, portray? I want to go so far as to say, like, this is an explicit prediction. You know, Moses, the author here, doesn't say, and in the same way, this will happen for a greater one eventually, right? But it's a pattern of someone dying a death of being hanged on a tree, while others receive life instead of that death on the third day. So that much at least we can glean from that text. Moving ahead in the narrative, just a couple of chapters. So Genesis 42, when Joseph is in Egypt and the famine in the land has spread even to Canaan, his brothers then have to go to Egypt, and they are confronted by Joseph without realizing that it's him. Joseph assigns them to prison. So there's an ironic twist, right? They had assigned him to prison somewhat indirectly. He assigns them to prison directly. But look at verse 17, so 42:17. And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. Verse 18, on the third day he said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. And then he goes on to tell them what he would have them to do. They're going to leave one brother behind while the rest are going to go back to their father. So I just would point out there that, again, here you have a group of people being graciously set free from their imprisonment on the third day. Right? Again, nothing more than that, but you have these patterns of these significant kinds of events happening, and they're even, not only are they set free, they're promised life. Do this and you will live. So being set free from imprisonment and being given life on the third day. So that would be number one in the life of Joseph. The second one is going to take us to Genesis 49. And the second and third one here are rather similar, and they're very closely related in the text. But at the end of Genesis 49, Jacob, the father of Joseph and his brothers, has come to the end of his life. He's announced a blessing on each of the 12 sons and their tribes that they would have possession of, authority over. And so Genesis 49:28, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing suitable to him. And he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people, burying me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. In verse 31, there they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites. And when Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. So we made reference of this kind of event last week, or was it 2 weeks ago? I think in talking about the end of Joshua. Why would Jacob in this example, or why would a person care where they were buried? What did that seem to imply? Bury me there because why? Okay. It seems to indicate that's where I want to live when my body is resurrected. That's where it's kind of this idea of I believe that I'm going to live again. These bones are going to live again. So that's where I want my bones to be, so that when my body gets life again, that's where I will live. I want to be in the land of my fathers. You know, he specifically mentions that's where Abraham was buried. It's where Isaac was buried. I want to be buried where my family is buried, where those of my ancestors, both physically and spiritually, were buried, because That's where I want to be raised from the dead. Seems to be the indication there. So that's number two. Number three is very similar in the very next chapter when Joseph says much the same thing, starting in Genesis 50:22. Let's actually just go jump directly to verse 24. So Genesis 50:24. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." So it's a promise. You're in Egypt for now, but you're not going to stay in Egypt. The Lord's going to deliver you. So he's remembering what the Lord had previously promised to Abraham, and he's saying he's going to deliver you out of this land. And so verse 25, "Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones up from here.' So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt." So similar kind of faith, I would say, being expressed there by Joseph. You know, I'm currently in Egypt, but don't leave me in Egypt. I don't want to be buried in Egypt. They put him in a coffin there, but the instructions are to, you know, carry my coffin when you come out of the land. And then interestingly, and you could turn there if you care to. In fact, yeah, let's go next to Exodus 13. And starting in verse 18. So in Exodus 13, this is after the Passover. This is as the Israelites are beginning their journey out of Egypt. Exodus 13, 18. "But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt, equipped for battle." In verse 19, "Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here.'" So even though something like 400 years worth of generations had passed, Moses, you know, that promise had gotten passed down to Moses. And Moses is able to then fulfill the wish of Joseph and carry his bones up out of the land. And then you could tie into that. We won't go and look at it because we looked at it a couple of weeks ago at the end of Joshua. But Joshua 24:32 is kind of the reburial of Joseph. At the same time, apparently, that Joshua is buried. And interestingly, both Joshua and Joseph both died at the same age, 110 years old. So died at the same age, even though many generations apart, but they kind of had a double funeral for them, so it seems, interestingly. Questions so far? I need to pause just a moment anyway. Questions or comments so far? Anything at all? when you say they,
these folks have gone through this,
it would be hard to answer whether or not they saw it in the moment. So somebody like Joseph, even as he's even saying, "Hey, this is going to happen on the third day," I don't know that he necessarily thought of it in the terms that we're talking about here. It's more likely that Moses, as the author, is recording this. Maybe he's picking up on that pattern, so he's maybe intentional in his writings to bring it out, make a point of it. And then I think that would make it likely that the authors who come after after Moses, in reading Moses' writings, recognize that as a pattern, and then they, as we're going to continue and see, they also make those kinds of comments in their writings as well. Yes, ma'am. I I don't think so. The references that I found on Joseph are the ones that I've shared with you. So from the time that he gives that command until the time that Moses picks it up, it's kind of uninformed about where it was or how it was kept. But then even as they journeyed, I don't know of another reference after this one in Exodus 13 until the one at the end of Joshua. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. That's possible. Okay. Let's look at a few more. These are some of these we'll be able to jump through a little more quickly. The next one is in Exodus 15, so just a little bit ahead of where we were. Exodus 13, they begin their journey. Exodus 14, they cross the Red Sea. Exodus 15, Miriam sings the song celebrating the crossing of the sea. And then at the end of Exodus 15, starting in verse 22, Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days' journey in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore, they named it Marah. That's what that word means. Verse 24, the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What should we drink?" He cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it in the water, and the water became sweet. So, again, nothing explicit. Don't want to say more than it says, except to point out that here's a situation where they know if they don't get water, they're going to die, and they don't have drinkable water, and then all of a sudden they have, on the third day, water that gives life. So it wouldn't be a stretch, I don't think, to say that they found the source of life. I guess you could even take the liberty of saying something like they found living water on the third day would be a way to say that. All right. Next one, number five, in Exodus 19. So they begin their journey, particularly towards Mount Sinai, because that's where the Lord had told Moses previously, "I'll meet with you again on this mountain." So they begin to work their way towards Mount Sinai. And in Exodus 19, they arrive at the mountain. And in Exodus 19:9, the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I'm coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear, and I hear when I speak to you, and may also believe you forever." When Moses told the words of the people to the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people." And so then there's these further instructions about how they're to consecrate themselves, to be holy, to not actually come near and touch the mountain, but to keep their distance from it, both man and beast, and that only Moses was to be the one to come up the mountain. And then verse 15, he relays these instructions. He said to the people, "Be ready for the third day." And then verse 16, "On the morning of the third day, there were thunders, lightnings, and a thick cloud on the mountain, a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled." So the summary I would give to this is that it's the third day when the Lord appears to his people. He shows up visibly in the presence, his presence made known to them on the mountain on the third day. So kind of a sampling, I guess, of some consecrated passages there in Genesis and Exodus. And then for the next one, we're going to jump ahead a fair amount, actually, in the timeline. So I'll pause here again, just ask if there's any comments, questions, raised eyebrows, any sort of thing. Is this making any sense at all? Okay, I hope. Again, just not wanting to harp too much on one or the other, but attempting to show kind of a larger pattern at work here. All right, here we go to the next one. This would be number six if you're counting the way I count, which is optional tonight. But this one is all the way into the minor prophets in the book of Hosea. So I'll give you some time to turn to Hosea. These last few are going to feel more like you're going to be going backwards on some of these, but I'm going more in the traditional order rather than the order we have it here, just to see if maybe it builds its case in a stronger way, perhaps. But Hosea chapter 6, and you may know the story of Hosea, where he himself was kind of given this task to act as the Lord had acted toward his people by marrying a wife. That wife then would turn out to be unfaithful to him, and yet he was commanded to pursue her, which he does, and attempting to win her back as an illustration for the way that the Lord had loved his own people and had not abandoned them in their departure from him. And so that's kind of the narrative of the book that you have there in the first couple of chapters, but then you've got several other chapters that not so much in narrative form, but just in its in these statements that Hosea makes, you have the Lord calling back to his people, and then you have the people, you have Hosea also calling to the people about what to do. So in Hosea 6, you have this, in verse 1, you have Hosea saying to the nation, "Come, let us return to the Lord." So they've abandoned him, and here's the prophet doing what prophets do and saying, "Let's return to the Lord." Why? So continuing there in 6:1, "For he has torn us that he may heal us. He has struck us down, and he will bind us up." All right, pause there. It's like Hosea is saying, he doesn't come out and say the Lord has killed us, right? It's not a statement of death, but it is a statement of, we've been torn, we've been struck down, and this has happened to us by the Lord. He has done this to us, and yet he's done this. He's torn us that he may heal us. He's struck us down, and he will bind us up. And when does Hosea see all of this happening? So look at verse 2. "After 2 days, he will revive us, and on the third day, he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Let us press on to know the Lord. His going out is sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers, as the spring rains that water the earth." So it's in the form of an invitation. Come, let us return to the Lord. Let us not wander from him. Let us not depart from him anymore. Let's return to him. He's torn us that he might mend us. He's struck us down that he might bind us up. And he will revive us. And on the third day, he will raise us up. So, it's hard to know exactly how to take some of this poetry or this prophetic language. Is he talking about like a literal 2 days, 3 days, kind of a time frame here? Maybe. If so, the details are to us unclear about what exactly that 3 day process would look like. Or he could just be thinking something, in his mind and writing out in a poetic way. Hey, just like in the books of Moses, we saw the Lord do these life-giving things on the third day. He will do that for us, and it will be like for us a third day of life from this being broken down state that we have got ourselves into. Something like that. So I wrote down here that regardless of what else you take from this, the nation, Hosea seems to indicate that the nation will be raised to life on the third day. Again, not from the dead necessarily, but if the Lord leaves them in that state, they would die, right? Like if he strikes them down or tears them up, again to borrow Hosea's language, and he leaves them in that state, they are as good as dead. And yet he won't do that for them. He will give them life. And Hosea says, on the third day he will raise us up. So I would suggest that he is saying that based on the patterns of things, like things we've looked at already. Yes, sir.
It would be interesting to look up. I don't know any different.
That's how they prepare for burial. That's true. Yeah. I'll run this by you next time so I can look all that up in advance. Yeah, that would be interesting. Okay, so that's an example. Let's look at let's go. This will be backwards for us, but let's go back to the book of Job. This one I think is quite familiar. In Job 19, my hope, Lord willing, is that after this Sunday, so starting in April, the first Sunday of April, the next thing we will attempt to go through on Sunday mornings is the book of Job, I hope. So if you want to prepare yourselves for that, maybe read some of it in advance. So I won't linger on this one because we'll come back to it hopefully in a month or two, this particular section. But in Job 19, Job has this to say about his own experience. And remember, this Job is in this condition where he also has been struck by the Lord. You know, physically, he's lost his sons and daughters. He's lost his health. He's in a great amount of pain. And so yet in that pain, he says in 19:23, "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever." Why, Job? Verse 25. "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth." So Job believes that he has a Redeemer. He believes that that Redeemer apparently will somehow come in a bodily way to stand upon the earth. And not only does the Redeemer live in a body, but verse 26, "And after my skin has been thus destroyed," and that's an interesting phrase because, you know, you go back to the first part of Job, that's exactly what had happened. You know, his skin had begun to be destroyed. But he seems to have more than that in mind. He says, "After my skin has been thus destroyed," seeming to speak of, you know, when my body dies, "yet in my flesh I will see God," or, you know, I think some translations might say, "with my eyes I will see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me." So Job, how is it that you in your body are going to see the Lord after your body has been destroyed? How can that happen? It can only happen if Job believes that his body is going to get up from the dead and see the Lord with new eyes. So we'll leave that one there because, as I said, we'll probably return to that one in due time. There are, I think, probably several psalms we could look at, but I'll point us to one in particular because of the way that it's used in the New Testament. So go to Psalm 16. Psalm 16. And if you want to, I might also suggest that if you'll have Psalm 16, but then also Acts chapter 2 in the New Testament, so that you can kind of see how the book of Acts references this, because it would be worth comparing this interpretation with the ones who have interpreted it before. So Psalm 16, and I will look at starting in verse 7. All right, so this is David, and I'll read this, but then I'll ask you, who is David talking about? Okay, so have that question in mind as I read this. Who does David seem to be talking about? Verse 7. Excuse me. I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. In the night also my heart instructs me. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. Verse 9, therefore my heart is glad, and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. So just kind of a snippet there, because there's more that comes before that in that psalm, but just a straightforward reading of it, who's David talking about there? It's not a trick question. Okay, he's talking about God, and he's talking about someone else.
Himself, he was prophesying Christ.
Okay. Jay, you were saying something, I think?
He
does. He's talking about the Lord, but he uses another pronoun there, or more pronouns there, that are in the first person, right? I bless the Lord who gives me counsel in the night. Also, my heart instructs me. I have set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. Verse 10, you will not abandon whose soul? My soul, right? So I would suggest that just in a straightforward reading of this, David is talking about himself. He's talking about himself. Now, Ken makes the exact correct point when he says, when he references that in Acts 2, starting in verse 25, Peter, in his sermon at Pentecost, says that David says concerning him, concerning Jesus, that's the what is it, Ken? The nearest pronoun? Or is it, yeah. Is that how you say it? Okay. The nearest pronoun is Jesus. What does he say concerning Jesus? I saw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand, and that I may not be shaken. And so he goes down and he references what we just read. In other words, Peter takes the stance that Psalm 16 is more than just about David. It's actually about Jesus. Look at how after he quotes this, look at verse 29. Brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses. So I agree with Peter and with Ken. I think that Peter has the right idea. This is about Jesus, but does that mean that let's just think about the way that this psalm would have been read even before before Jesus. Every reader of this psalm before Jesus would have assumed David's talking about who?
Himself.
And I would say they are also right. In other words, can David be talking about both himself and someone else? Can what David is saying be true about more than one person? I would say yes. In fact, I think that's how a lot of the messianic psalms work, is that David says things like this, like, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol. Or he would say in Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And David is writing that because he feels forsaken by the Lord. And then when Jesus comes along and either, you know, like in that case, says the same thing on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus seems to understand, I've fulfilled the pattern that was set by David. You know, I'm the greater David. He doesn't come out and say that again, but that's, why else would he quote that except to, you know, not out of random happenstance, but by intentional I'm the ultimate sufferer. I'm the ultimate one forsaken by God. You know, David just set the pattern before me. And Peter seems to kind of take this same stance. In Acts 13, it's similar, where Paul references this same psalm. So Acts 13:35. Therefore, he says also in another psalm, "You will not let your Holy One see corruption." So he quotes there from that psalm. And then verse 36, "For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid with his fathers and saw corruption. But he whom God raised up did not see corruption." In other words, he didn't stay dead, right? He didn't stay in the grave. And both Paul and Peter there are kind of saying the same thing. So again, I agree with them. I agree with that interpretation. Yes, it's ultimately about Christ, but I would say don't skip past the fact that David is really very clearly, if we just take him at his own words, he's talking about himself. Now, Peter is rightly able to say, essentially, David's still in the tomb. We could go to his grave and I could show it to you. You know, they could have done that because David had not yet been resurrected. And in fact, to our day, David is still in the grave, which makes it seem like David was wrong. It kind of seems like God has abandoned David to the grave. And yet, I would just add, David's faith in writing this, I think, seems to indicate, I won't stay in the grave forever. You know, just like there's a greater one coming after me whose body won't stay in the grave, neither will mine. That's what I would understand him to be saying. Yes?
Just thinking that the Psalms are poetry.
Yeah.
And poetry often uses figurative language.
Yep.
Which is why a lot of people hate poetry, because you've got to interpret it as you read it.
Yeah.
So that even though, you know, as you just said, a twofold fulfillment.
That's exactly right.
Figurative language and then literal language.
Yeah. And that's I like the way you said that, a twofold fulfillment, because a lot of times we want to make these one-to-one correspondences between, well, here's the Old Testament prediction or something like that, and here's the New Testament fulfillment, when a lot of times these kinds of things that get talked about in the Old Testament get fulfilled in like leveled and layered ways at multiple points in time. There's examples we could look at to kind of show that or illustrate that, but you know, this I think is one of those. You know, which resurrection is David talking about? I tend to think he's talking about his own. Paul and Peter seem to think he's talking about Jesus's, and I would say, why can't it be both? And you know, that's how I would see this. And again, you could, I don't know. I'm not claiming to have all the answers on this. This seems to be a statement of David's own faith in, my body's not going to stay in the grave. The Lord will not abandon my soul to Sheol. He will not let me see corruption forever. All right, that one was a little more detailed. There's two more I want to get to. Let's see if we have time. Other thoughts here so far? We're doing okay on time, I think. Trying to wrap us up by 8. We've got a little bit of time. Here we go. Next one is in Daniel. The very end of Daniel, Daniel 12. And the statement I want to look at is in Daniel 12, but I would remind us of some of the more familiar things that have already happened in the book of Daniel up to this point. In Daniel 1, you have Daniel and his three friends who survive this invasion by the Babylonian army. They are brought into Babylon and given an ordinance about, you know, this is what your diet should be, this is what language you'll speak, and all the rest. And Daniel stands up to King Nebuchadnezzar and says, well, you know, we want to eat this food instead. And you know, it turns out that ends up being good for him. In Daniel 2, you have the dream by the king that no one can interpret, and then of course Daniel is able to interpret it, and the penalty for not being able to interpret it was death. So you have, even in the first couple of chapters, situations where Daniel really should have died, and yet he lives, right? And then in Daniel 3, you have the three friends of Daniel thrown into the fiery furnace. They should have died, and yet they live. Daniel 6, you have Daniel thrown into the lion's den. He should have been lion's dead, but instead he's alive out of the lion's den. So you already have these examples throughout Daniel where it seems like life is happening where death should happen. And then you get to Daniel 12, and he writes in verse 1, at that time, so speaking of a future time, at that time shall arise Michael, the great prince, who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And what will happen to these people? Verse 2. And many of these who sleep in the dust of the earth. Okay, what is that a kind of a euphemism for? To sleep in the dust of the earth means to be dead, to be buried, right? Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who sleep shall awake. Those who sleep in the earth, those who die and are buried, shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to everlasting shame and contempt. So even Daniel, both through the things that just kind of happen in his life and then also here very clearly at the end of his book, believes and illustrates and shows how this one, this idea of resurrection. Jay, do you need a hand getting out the front door? Okay. All right. There's one more, and this one is, I'll kind of give this to you, and you can think about it, because this is one that I heard someone mention fairly recently. I hadn't thought about it before. It could be brilliant. It could be way out there. I don't know. I'll tell it to you, and I'll let you decide. Where is, this should be easy, do not overthink this, where is the first time in the Bible where we read about a third day? In creation, right? Evening and morning was the first day, evening and morning was the second day, evening and morning was the third day. The third day of creation is the first time in the Bible where you read about something that is able to reproduce life after itself. Okay, it's about the vegetation on the land. So the trees bear seed. That seed, you know, would fall to the ground and die, and it would reproduce itself and, in a sense, live again. Right. So right there in Genesis 1, you have something that would bring forth life on the third day. Jesus, in John 12, compares his own life to a seed-bearing tree, right? Unless a grain of wheat falls to the earth and dies, it cannot bear fruit. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Using just a common illustration from nature, that the only way that life can actually come from that seed, from any seed, is to die itself and be put into the earth so that it can spring forth life. That's the only way that life can come. And then, in our chapter that we've examined already somewhat, but 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, In verse 35, someone will ask, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? So remember, he's talking not just about Jesus' resurrection, but about resurrection in general. How can something dead be raised? And Paul says to the person who would ask this in verse 36, you foolish person, What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain. But God gives it a body as He has chosen, and to each kind of seed its own body. And it goes on, I won't read all of it, but Paul says basically the same thing there that Jesus says in John 12, which is the kind of body that we will be raised in will come from this first body being put in the earth and planted like a seed and then raised to new life, just the way that life comes from seeds that get buried in the earth. Because unless that seed gets buried in the earth, no life can come from it. And the very first time you have language like that in the whole Bible is in the story of creation, and it happens on the third day. Like I said, you would have to think about that. I want to think some more about that because, again, I don't want to read into it what's not there, but that's interesting, to say the least. Whether that's a legitimate connection that would tie into all this, I don't know. But I hope, just through looking at some of these, you see at least a small thread of these patterns that seem to be here. And again, the point that I would make is simply to say that when Paul makes a statement like death and third day resurrection being according to the scriptures, these are the at least the kinds of things that he has in mind. That it's not just random, it's not even just in one place, but it's these patterns that build onto one another in such a way that one reading the Old Testament, you know, and I would say the Old Testament authors themselves would even look at those patterns and recognize them and think, this means something, like something significant is going to happen. And I'm not saying that Hosea or Daniel or any of these people necessarily could articulate it and say, oh, this means our rescuer, our Messiah is going to come and live and then die and then be raised on the third day. I don't know that they could have articulated it that way, but probably there's these patterns of things that they recognized that, you know, there's significance about, you know, there's a hope for the resurrection, there's significance about life being, you know, raised from the dead, and there's significance about a lot of these significant things happening on the third day. And so that when Paul says that, it would be like, okay, that's how it all is put together. That's my contention. So, yes, go ahead. You gotta know. Okay. I'll give you my. I'll give you. What's that? He did. That's true. My wife is afraid of what I'm going to say because I had the audacity to bring this discussion up at a Thanksgiving dinner recently. That's okay. Here's my opinion, all right? As the pastor that I grew up under would say, and I'll have to change the amount because of inflation, but this and $1.50 will get you a Coke at the AC&T across the street. It's worth that much. My opinion is that the normal biblical pattern for the way the body is to be treated and even reverenced is to bury it rather than to burn it. As I understand, like the origins of burning dead bodies, that was a pagan practice. It was something that was, it was basically a way of saying, the earth is done with this body, so we're done with this body, and we're just going to burn it up because we have no use for it anymore, ever again. Whereas the Judeo-Christian view, because they believed that that body would live again, they reverenced it in such a way that we're not going to burn this. We're going to plant it in the ground so that it can bloom again as a living thing. You know, it can be raised from the dead. So that seems to be the, again, the normal pattern, kind of the biblical expectation. It's an expression of faith that this the world is not done with this body. It will live again. Again, that's my interpretation of that. And so my opinion is that burial as opposed to cremation is to be preferred. Now, my wife would say, do you want to say it? Yeah, go ahead. What would you say to me? She's like, just burn me up. I don't want... She has this... She's like, don't have an open casket. I don't want people coming to look at me while I can't, you know, do anything. Like, close the casket, burn me up. Anyway, so she has said, just burn me. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. But the reason is, again, just because what it symbolizes, what it expresses. And she would say, this is what I thought you would say, is that if God wants to raise me, he can put all my ashes back together no matter where they are. Amen. Right? And I agree with that. I Oh, man. Anyways, so that's... And I agree with that. Okay, so like again, like what happens if your body gets, what if you die in a fire, right? What if you get blown to bits in war? What if, as my student said, his greatest fear was, what if you fall into a wood chipper feet first? He said that was his greatest fear. Exactly. You know, like what happens in that case? Well, okay, yeah, you can't bury that body in the same way, and I get that. And so, like, I have family members who've been cremated. There's nothing, I would not say that it is, sinful or disobedient or anything like that. I just, it seems to me that there's a type of reverence for the body that the Bible has that other belief systems, other worldviews, other religions don't have. And so, to me, the way to honor that is to bury a body, and that's a preference I have because... What's that? And move it out of Egypt later, yeah. So... you've heard, she won't know, exactly. You've heard her wishes, and I've expressed mine. And, either way. Go ahead, Chuck. And that, yeah. So you can honor your wife that way if you desire. Yeah. No, it's a good question. Okay. Yeah. And like I said, I've been to funerals of family members who've, whose ashes we've scattered, excuse me, different places. And then never mind. Just don't do it on a windy day, because I've been there. Yes. Yeah, and I would concede that. Entirely, yeah. No matter how you're, and even the body, once it's buried, right, it doesn't stay whole. It decomposes, right? It turns to dust anyway. I'm with all of that. I fully, yes, the Lord can put together your body. I will say this, and this might be where you were going, Miss Lovis, is that I think, again, I don't have all the answers for exactly how this plays out, but, you know, Jesus's body, when Jesus died, he was put in the grave. Was the same body that was put in the grave the same body that lived again? Was it the same one?
No, because he could walk through the wall.
You say no?
It's not the same, because now he can go through walls.
Okay. Even though before he could walk on water. I'm just asking. I know that sounded like a smart aleck, and it just happens sometimes. Yeah. No. So I would say it is. It's the same body. If it's not the same body, it's not resurrection, it's recreation. Right? It doesn't unless something that actually died lives again, that's not resurrection. So the point of that is the body that you and I die in, like it or not, is the body you will have forever. It's the same one.
That's the point, that the body that you plant is the body
yeah.
that will come up.
Yeah. And there are changes, okay? So I admit, yeah, yes, there are changes. Yes, there is a glorification process that none of us have yet experienced. I can tell you haven't experienced it yet. I can look in the mirror and tell I haven't experienced it yet. But it's coming, okay? It's coming. And again, I don't have all the answers because I'm not there yet, but I just... I have answers. That's right. I have answers. No, you're not. That's right. I do. This is good. No, you did great. This is. I enjoy this. This is helpful. Sometime later. Yes, I will do that. I thought that's what this was, but I guess I'll do it again later. Yeah. No, great questions, and I do have answers. I have thought about this. You know, and I don't say any of this to gain any sympathy from you, but one of the reasons I've thought about this is because I've been to a lot of I've been to a lot of funerals of a lot of people very close to me. You know, when my dad went to be with the Lord and I was 14 years old, you know, obviously there's a lot of things that strike you in that moment, but ever since then, I remember just being able to kind of think and try to make sense of what exactly that meant for him, right? I could still go, and my mom has since joined him. I could do like what Peter says he could do for David. I could take you and show you their graves. I could show you where their bodies are now. I can also confidently say they're not there, right? They're absent from the body right now. They're present with the Lord in whatever condition that looks like. And I can also confidently say that those bodies, in whatever state of decomposition they're in right now, will not stay in that state forever. They will live again. And to me, that's a hopeful thing, you know, that I'm going to see them again. And I'm not going to see some new version of them. I'm going to see them. It's going to be them. And they're going to see me. And I know all of us have lost folks. And so, again, I don't say that like, out of pity. I just mean, like, these thoughts are not just something like I've looked at and thought about from the reading of certain texts or books. Like, I've had to process this, you know, in personal ways. And so you just, to me, it's the reason I harp on it, if it sounds like I'm harping on it, is because it does matter for the way I think about the world, the way I think about life and death. And it does for all of us. And that's why you're asking these questions, I know. So yes, ma'am. I suppose so.
A horror story. my niece was cremated.
or make sure if they are cremated, you know where they're at, I guess. You have all kinds of freedom on this. It's not a matter of conscience, in my opinion. That's like I said, it's my opinion. Let me pray. And then we can talk more if you care to. Lord, we are glad for the things from your word that are clear to us. And we pray for wisdom to help navigate through the things that are less clear. But we do understand that one of the things that is abundantly apparent throughout the scriptures is that the grave does not have the final say. That death one day will be no more, that death will be swallowed up in victory, that the grave itself will be buried and put away forever. So we're glad for that, and we have hope in that because we believe that that is what has happened for the Lord Jesus. And Thank you that he has walked that path before us, and that that we know, as was mentioned, that when we see him, we will be like him, for we shall see him as he is, that we will be changed, that our lives, our existence forever is not just spiritual, but it's physical, that we will have life in the future in much the same way we have it now, but in an eternally perfect way, free from sin and death. And so we long for that day. And until then, keep us faithful to continue to search the scriptures and to trust you for these things. In Jesus' name, amen.